Perfect. So we're going to welcome back Nicolai Vasquez, who's going to talk about some tight tips and tricks. Hopefully we all pick something really useful up. Thank you very much.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. This is... Happy to be back at FOSDEM, my second FOSDEM and second time speaking, so been looking forward to it. So the topic today is about using Rust type system in advanced ways that will assume a decent knowledge of Rust beforehand. I'm not going to be covering many basics. So if you get lost, it's not entirely your fault. But otherwise, you can look up references for what I cover. So before I get started, one of the motivations for this talk is that a lot of the techniques I use are in my benchmarking library, Devon. A show of hands, who here has heard of Devon? OK, nice. So a decent amount. So this was my talk at FOSDEM last year, was introducing Devon. And so it takes advantage of the type system in very interesting ways, as you'll see. And before I get started, I'm hoping to make Devon a full-time job and build a team around it. So I'm looking for sponsorship to help make that a reality. So please check out the project and send money towards it if you can. Thank you. So the topics that I'm going to be covering are type states, conditional typing, polymorphic callbacks, and type erasure. Type states are an extension of the builder pattern. So you might be familiar with this in Rust, where rather than calling a function that takes all the parameters, you can instead provide individual options where some of them aren't always necessary. However, one nice thing about the type state pattern is that you can make some options actually be necessary. So for example, if we remove the name method call here, we can actually get a compile error saying that the default name unset was not convertible to a string. And so if the user doesn't provide a name here for the config, then you get a compile error instead of a runtime error. And the way this works is you have to set a default generic state where we know that this is not going to implement into string. And so as a result, when we later end up calling build, we know that, okay, well, the name method needed to be provided at some point. And so the way this ends up working is essentially you have a state transition from a default name unset state to then providing some generic end name. And then that wouldn't be checked until you call build. You could also provide the name into string at the name call site itself as well. But in the end, this will end up getting checked. So this technique is not just good for configuration with data, but you can also use it to configure how execution works. And so in Devon, there's this bencher that you can take optionally if you want to provide context to your benchmarks, and then you can pass it a closure by default to iteratively keep calling the function and measure its performance. However, what you can also do instead is you can take you can pass another closure to generate inputs for every single iteration. And so what this now does is it makes another method available called bench values, as well as it makes other intermediate builder methods also available. So for example, if you wanted to count throughput of bytes from your given inputs, this can be provided as a statically checked string, rather than just something that gets checked dynamically at runtime. So if we were to remove the with inputs, we would see, that when we call bench values, it's saying that there's unsatisfied trait bounds. And the way this works is that the bencher type will take a bencher config by default, and then that is itself a public and private type, which essentially means that it is, while it's technically public, it never gets actually exported by the crate, so it never gets possible to use outside of the crate. And so we can wrap all of our generic parameters inside of this bencher config. Here we only just have one, which is generate input. And so as a default, there's the it's essentially like the unit type where you have an empty tuple, but instead it's an unnameable public and private type. And this default itself is not a function. And so when you try to call the bench method as if you had the bench values as if you had called a provided a function, then that won't work at compile time. And we can see how this gets enforced later in the impls, where the bench method just is implemented on the default bencher type with the default bencher config. And then we have a bench values method that will take the gen input generic parameter that was provided before and then actually invoke it to perform the benchmarking. So type states give us a lot of benefits. They allow us to move checking your inputs to compile time. And this ends up having runtime performance improvements in that you only end up paying for fields that you end up setting, as well as if, like, so rather than another runtime improvement is that rather than be checking at runtime whether your inputs are valid, you instead just get compile errors. And that ends up being also just a lot clearer for users as to how they're using your library incorrectly. Another topic I'd like to cover is conditional typing, or what I like to call dependent types at home. So say you have a function to log the throughput of bytes that you're processing. And you may consider that that should take u size because lengths for slices use u size. And for context, u size is essentially just an unsigned integer that's the same size as a pointer. So it can be the length of the whole address space. And if we had this as u size and we wanted it to work with not just slices, but we also wanted it to work with files, well, file lengths require u64. And so now we have this type mismatch. And if we ended up trying to use this for slices, then we end up saying, OK, well, sure, we can cast it to U64. But say, for example, let's just say U size ended up becoming larger than U64 in a hypothetical 128-bit platform that Rust would support. And you could try to support both of these by wrapping them in an enum. And one of the main downsides of this is now you have a whole extra word just to determine, well, is this a U size or U64, just to determine the size. And so there is a bit of a performance penalty here. You could also consider, well, let's just use unions instead. However, now you end up reaching for unsafe. So the very creative alternative to this is you can end up making a type alias to either U size or U64. And the way that you end up doing that is abusing the trait system. So you could parameterize a trait based off of a type or a const condition. In this case, what I'm doing is I'm making this usize 64 associated type be available for the empty tuple type just as a placeholder. And we make it available for the condition of is pointer greater than U64 true, we make it be U size. Otherwise, if U size is smaller than U64, then we want this associated type to be U64. And if we end up using this, we can use this lovely syntax of, okay, empty tuple as proxy U64 and access the associated type. But we can see that we're actually using U size or U64, we can assign it to an integer directly. And it's not just like wrapping it with an enum or a union. And so we're using the type directly itself. I published a crate called ContType that provides a generic type alias that for this technique. And so you could also define U size 64 in terms of this type alias. And we see here that you can just use it, for example, to assign it to any integer. And if you're going to use, ends up taking different types as the input for the callback. So in this next version of Devon, we'll have runtime benchmark registration. And to make this API very flexible, it could either take a Devon bencher, which has a subtle difference from Devon bench that I'm not going to get into, but it'll be clear in the API eventually. And sorry, I didn't mean to write bencher twice there. But we see that we are able to invoke the same exact API, but we're able to provide it with three different types of closures. Two of them that take parameters that are different parameters, and then one that doesn't take any parameters. And the way that this flexibility is achieved is with a separate trait, where the key feature here is that we're providing this marker type that essentially allows us to implement this trait generically without having conflicting implementations. So in the actual implementation, we see that we end up passing as the marker type fn of bencher, fn of bench, and then empty fn. And this is just to essentially implement a kind of a different trait for every instance. And we know that we're not going to get a closure that is going to implement both fn, fn bench, and fn bencher. And so we don't end up having any ambiguity errors when we end up trying to use this. And Devon's not the only library that uses this technique. This technique is also utilized by Bevy's ECS engine, where you can handle quite a flexible number of parameters as dependency injection. And the way that this ends up working in practice, or at least the way it's implemented, rather, is using the same underlying technique, where we have this generic trait for all of the functions that we're going to run against, and it takes this marker parameter to essentially indicate to the compiler that, okay, these are separate implementations, and you don't end up with the error of multiple implementing the same trait across multiple generic types, which is a limitation of the compiler right now until we end up getting specialization, which may never land. We'll see. So the actual implementation for this in Bevy ends up becoming pretty gnarly. I don't recommend that your use case has to be this complicated, but for them, they had specific lifetime needs for this parameter that I'm not going to get into how that works. You can dig into the source code yourself. But this is just another example of how this technique is used to provide a much more flexible API in a widely used game engine. So as I covered, this works really well if you want to implement dependency injection in your library. It allows your API to be much more flexible. And as a result of this flexibility, you end up with fewer functions or a smaller API surface to expose. And internally, because you're operating over a unified trait for different implementations, the internal implementation can also end up being simpler. And the last topic I'd like to cover is type erasure. So you're probably familiar with the type erasure that's provided by the standard library, or by the language out of the box. And this is with the dyne trait. And while this ends up, or also known as trait objects, while this ends up working fairly well, it is limited in some ways. So for example, if you wanted a slice of type-erased objects, then you can't really erase a slice to be dyne trait slice. That's just not a feature that's available right now in the language. And so what Devon does instead to get past this is implement its own vtable for type erasure. So you end up having a bunch of different operations that are the first operations end up being for the identity, so displaying to users, you know, what types are you operating over, and then for the actual type ID to be able to distinguish, okay, when I'm actually recreating these objects, like, are these actually the same type that I expect them to be, as well as if you want to co-locate objects of the same type, then this type ID ends up becoming important. I don't recommend using the address to an erase type or the address of the type ID function itself, which is something that some people do. Type ID itself is guaranteed to provide the uniqueness, whereas if you're across different compilation units, you may end up with different addresses but the same type ID. So do invoke the function to get the type ID. And then we have other properties for memory management, so the actual size to determine, okay, when we're storing this in a slice, what's the actual stride? How far do you need to increment a pointer to actually iterate over a slice? And then for deallocating slices, we store a function to provide that. And then actual functionality on these erased objects hints at what's to come. We see that these actual provided values don't end up getting used. They have an underscore in front of them to hint that the values end up getting dropped. And the reason for that is we're going to magically transport these closures into the implementation. And the reason that this is legal is we can guarantee at compile time that the size of these closures is zero. And so because it's a zero size type, as well as it's not a special token type guaranteed by copy, send, sync, et cetera, and static, we can guarantee that we can actually just construct one of these out of thin air. And this is how you're able to go from a generic closure type to being able to create a function pointer that invokes it separately. So you could also use this technique to implement certain like FFI patterns, but yeah, it's a neat trick that ends up actually ironically simplifying a lot of the code I end up having in Devon. So to recap on type erasure, by using custom vtables, you have a lot more fine control over the operations that you can do. So for example, to go back to what I was mentioning with these different operations, with Devon, you end up being able to, there's an option of, so for example, there's an option of bool here with the equality function, because what I'm not going to cover here, but one technique that you can do is you can use deref specialization to check, okay, is this type actually equatable or does it not implement that? Likewise, you can use deref specialization to pick debug versus display, and as well as checking if asref to stir is possible. So that's why two of these functions are fallible, and the other one has the same signature between display and debug, so ends up being the same regardless. But anyway, so that's why there's a lot more flexibility. It's just you're able to define exactly what the operations that are being provided are, not just based off of the direct trait implementations. However, this does require a decent amount of unsafe code, so use at your own risk. I highly recommend running your code through MIRI if you're going to do this. It's able to catch memory leaks, undefined behavior. It's an excellent tool. So these are all the techniques that I covered. They're definitely very niche. However, knowing that they exist can actually save your bacon. So I'm very happy that I've been able to take advantage of them. And maybe you all can come up with some cursed stuff to do as well. And that is all. I went through it quicker than I expected. and so I'm open to taking questions. Just one last thing. Like I said, I'm looking for sponsorship or contributors on Devon.
Can you please stay seated until the questions are over? Thank you.
So like I said at the beginning, I'm hoping to really make Devon a world-class benchmarking library, so I'm looking for sponsorship and contributors. So please reach out to me, either any of these by email, GitHub, Mastodon. And yeah, otherwise, happy to answer questions about anything I covered here.
Are there any questions?
So first off, awesome talk. And one of the issues I've often had with APIs that use patterns like these is that the docs are really hard to traverse because you can hardly find which values are okay to pass. And similarly, the compiler is often less helpful. Is this something you've faced in Devon, and have you thought about it?
Sorry, I can't hear the microphone.
Is this better?
A little bit. Try projecting okay. A little more, sorry.
I will try to talk slowly. So often it's hard if you're using an API like that uses these things to find out in the docs like which values are okay to pass on, and the compiler is often also unhelpful. Is this something you've also encountered in Devon, and is it something you've thought about?
I'm sorry, please repeat the question one more time because it's actually very difficult to hear you from here.
Yeah, sorry. Often with APIs like these, the documents like documentation is hard to read because the types are difficult and the compiler is often unhelpful. Is this something you've also encountered in Devon and thought about?
Sorry, the last thing I heard was compiler something. Sorry, that's so difficult.
Sometimes these APIs are difficult to use and because you're passing functions in and stuff like this. The compiler is sometimes unhelpful with this. So is there anything that you do to mitigate this or document it?
Yeah, so unfortunately, when it comes to resolving certain trait bounds, the Rust compiler will not be that much better than trying to use C++ templates, where it'll just try to lead you the wrong direction. I guess my advice here is if you do require trait bounds, try to require them, I guess, as early as you need them, and that there you at least like know at the first use site what's the associated issue. So for example, in the type state builder example I gave, the name method didn't actually require that the end type implements into string, but perhaps it would actually be better to have that there, because if you end up not invoking that name method, or rather, if you end up invoking that name method the wrong way, then you get that error there instead of right at the part you call build. Aside from that, I don't know, you're just kind of at the mercy of the compiler giving good error messages. If you want good progress on that, go sponsor Esteban Kuber. He does a great job with improving the compiler messages.
Are there any more questions?
Hi, thanks for your nice talk. I have a question about your type states example. So it's of course nice to have a possibility to fail at the compile time when you use the API incorrectly, but the error messages are not very nice. Is there a way to improve them?
The error messages are what, sorry?
Like, the error messages are not very clear, so it doesn't say that, you know, name is missing. It just says that type doesn't have, trait doesn't have an implementation.
Yeah, I guess my answer to that is similar to, the last
four structs.
I mean, I guess that potentially that could be used to improve the error message when you end up calling build without the right trait impulse. So yeah, theoretically that would help. I didn't know about that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? No? Thank you very much, Nikolai.